Hi guys, and welcome to another episode of Brown Car Guy and Buddies. And today I'm going to be talking to the CEO of the British Motor Show, Andy Entwistle. Now, the British Motor Show was supposed to be relaunched, rebooted, if you like, this year in 2020. But obviously, because of obvious reasons such as COVID, it couldn't happen. And it will now happen next year. Of course, these days, there's also a lot of pressure on motor shows globally because there's been a little bit of a decline and there is a need to sort of reinvent them, reimagine them, and evolve them. And Andy has a lot of ideas on how to do that, and we'll be getting into that. But also, I need to ask him about the fact that he seems to be a serial car buyer. He's owned over 150 cars. What's that all about? Well, I'll be asking him. Before we do that, make sure that you're subscribing to youtube.com/browncarguy. Make sure to follow me on all the social media channels. Just search for the hashtag. You can see it on my hat there. That's #browncarguy on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And of course, subscribe to browncarguy.com. You can also sponsor my content on patreon.com/ShazadSheikh. Cool, let's get into this. Hi Andy, how you doing? It's been ages since I saw you, on Saturday, wasn't it?
Yeah, days ago. Seems like forever.
Yeah, but a lot's been going on, as we know, a lot of news as well currently. And just before we came on air, we were discussing about another major event that's been cancelled. It's an inevitable part of what's going on, I suppose.
Just feel like that's the case at the moment. I think there's a lot of people really hoping that we'd be able to do something at the end of the year. But you know, with this potential kind of second lockdown coming, or at least a tightening, I think the rest of this year is a write-off for anyone in events.
Yeah, in terms of that, that was pretty bad. Before we get into events, because obviously you're the CEO of the British Motor Show, and we're obviously going to talk about that a lot, but I want to take you back in time a little bit and start sort of earlier on in your life, because you said you became aware of cars as soon as you were old enough to play with Matchbox toys.
Absolutely. So you can see, I've still got, they're slightly bigger than Matchbox, but I've still got a load of models here. And I do have in the loft my original box of Matchbox cars.
So I was going to ask you, I mean, I can see that. And as you know, I've got a couple of models here and some dotted around. So I'm a bit like you, but maybe not quite to the scale. How many Matchbox models do you have? Do you know?
I've got two tins of them. And I reckon there's probably about 50. It's not all of them, but there's about 50, of which half are pretty good. And half of them were used very well, shall we say.
That's good. They should be played with. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So those are a future investment. You've had 50 Matchbox models, but have I read this correct? You've owned 150 cars, like full-size real cars?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
No, I do have a bit of an issue. I'm terrible. I've always got two or three things on the go, and I'm not talking about, then we're not talking about top end stuff. I've not owned like 150 Ferraris or anything, but I've owned a lot of cars because I have a tendency, I'll buy a car, I'll have a play, and then I'll get bored and I'll think, right, what's next? And that's my problem. I love cars, and there's so many out there that I've not owned yet. So I'll be like, right, I've not owned one of those. I've got to have a play, and I'll buy it and I'll drive it, and I might be a little disappointed, and I'll be right, okay, tick that one. Where am I off to next? I'm terrible. It's you know, all of my friends and my poor other half just despair for me.
So how often are you changing cars?
It depends, really. So I've, you know, the longest I've owned a car is a couple of years. But that
that's
wasn't
the longest you've owned the
that's
car.
That's the longest I've ever owned a car. And that was my old 996.
All right. Okay. So is that one of your favorites then?
Yes, it is. And I had a 996 C4S. I had it for 2 years. Sold it to pay for a bit of work on a house. And regretted it immediately, so I've just bought another one. So that's a favourite in there. Probably the shortest is about 7 days. And so at the moment, I've got an XK8, I've got my 996, I've got a Z3, and I've got a Range Rover Sport. And that doesn't exclude the other half's car. I've had the XK8 since the beginning of lockdown. It's been fun, but I'm now thinking I'm going to move that on, and I'm going to buy a Mini Clubman that I'm going to convert to a pickup for the British Motor Show. So you can see, I'm just... The problem is, everyone who knows me knows that they put an idea in my head, I'll go and do it.
How's the XK8 been? Have you been using that regularly?
Kind of on and off. It's done 180,000 miles. So it was a long-legged car. But it drives okay. I've had a couple of little problems, so it's not gone out as much as normal. But it's... I tell you, it's the first one I've owned, and it's a really comfortable car. But it's kind of, I've got the Range Rover Sport for the winter.
Yeah.
And that's a really comfortable car. So I'm kind of thinking, well, actually, I probably won't use it. So rather than it just sit there and deteriorate at that kind of mileage, it's got to be used. I'm going to move it on. But it's, yeah, I've enjoyed it. It's good.
Yeah, it's the sort of car at the moment, to be honest, that I've kind of, you know, because I used to say a few years ago that by getting to XJSs, because they were going to go up in value. Yeah. And I think that's now going to start to happen to XK8s, especially early XK8s, because they're starting to look sexy again, especially that original shape. Which year was yours?
It's an early one. It's 97.
Right, right. But so that whole, that cigar shape, that fuselage
Absolutely.
Shape.
Yeah. Coupe, it's the one to have. And despite its mileage, it's worn it really well. And I bought it for nothing. You know, I paid $3,000 for the car, which is cheap. And you're right, they're already, you can see some really, really good ones going for $7,000, $8,000, $9,000.
Wow.
And that's my problem, of course, because I'm always, I buy a car, I might like it, then someone says to me, I'll give you an extra $500, it's gone. But you know, for a petrol head and a guy that's into the automotive industry, I hate losing money on cars. I've got a real thing about that.
So have you always made money on the cars that you've had, the 150 cars that you've had?
No, God, no. No, I'd be something special if I did that. No, I've lost a fair amount of money along the way, but I don't like it. I had a Maserati Ghibli, three-year-old Maserati Ghibli last year. And I decided to sell that when lockdown hit. I wasn't really using it, couldn't justify having it sitting there. Needed to put the money back into the business. And I lost, I didn't lose a great deal, but I lost a few grand on that. And that hurt.
Was that the car that was at the press conference last year?
That is the car, yeah.
I think I remember doing donuts around it.
Yeah, that's right. Paul Swift said, put your car there. And then started taking everyone around it. I've not owned it that long at that point. But, I mean, a great car. Absolutely loved it, but just couldn't justify keeping it. I lost a few quid, and that sticks to my throat. So, you know,
oh,
I like
to be
smart and sell smart.
And so what have been the highlights in terms of the cars? You know, that's one of the cars that you obviously wasn't great. But what are the highlights that you really enjoyed, miss, or feel like?
Yeah, there's a few that stick out. I had a 993. It was a C2, but it was a wide-bodied C2, so it looked like a turbo. Really rare car. Very late one. Loved that car and sold that, and again regretted selling that. Sold it for about $25,000. Oh, 15 years ago, it's now worth $50,000-$60,000. So that sticks out. A Clio Williams.
Oh, loved nice.
So I had one of those, and again sold that. But it wasn't a collectible car at the time. It was like a four or 5 year old car. Did my bit, moved it on. That's another one I really miss. Mm. God, there's loads of them. There's loads of my. I could bore you all day on that.
I think we need a longer video for that. I think
absolutely,
that's
yeah.
But is it all European then, the cars? Because so far the ones that you've mentioned, or have you bought any Japanese or by any chance any American stuff?
Yeah, no. So I'm a big fan of American cars, but I've never really owned any. My dream car and the one I've not owned so far is a Mustang. Love Mustangs, like a 64 coupe like that, or of course Eleanor. We all want Eleanor.
Yeah. Got the bullet stang there, so
yeah, got the bullet one, and I've got there we go. That's
cute, that's nice. That's a 64, is it? Convertible,
yeah, that is a 64 convertible. Yeah. I'd go for the coupe, but that 64 convertible. I've had quite a lot of Japanese. I'm a big fan of Japanese cars. I've actually imported a few as well. I've imported a Cube in my time,
and
a Nissan Elgrand. Which we called Bertha, and it's this huge Nissan bus. It's like an 8-seater bus with the 3.5-liter engine from the 350Z. So it's got go. So yeah, that was quite good fun. Very lively in the wet.
I bet. No, amazing car history. I'll tell you what, that's incredible. If you had 150 cars at one point, you could have had your own motor show anyway. You wouldn't need
any. Absolutely. You know, I didn't think about that. All the ones I've owned, I'm like, if I had that, we're laughing. So I'm very lucky I did that. And then prior to starting the motor show, you know, I ran a media company. So we used to get
We'll get to that. But it's 20 years in the car industry. I mean, it's a substantial journey. And you've done quite a lot of stuff, including work with manufacturers. So one of the places you worked with was with Mercedes.
That's right, yeah.
So how was that experience? That was embedded right inside the industry itself, wasn't it?
Yeah, so that was a really interesting one. So I ran their operational center in Maastricht. So Mercedes-Benz centralized all of their European operations to Maastricht. And we had 11 countries, 5 language groups over there, and I went over and I managed that for a while. So that included customer service, sales support, and breakdown stuff like that. And they built this fantastic operation, wonderful office over there, but they were really struggling to make it work properly. And my background at that point was very operational, people management. So I went out there for a couple of years and helped with that. Great fun. Interesting times, because that was the time when, I mean, Mercedes, you'll know, went through a bit of a wobble. They'd been making bulletproof cars.
Yeah.
And then in the late 90s, they had a few issues. Kind of, they were maybe not
M-Class,
making
M-Class.
Yeah, M-Class. And the E-Class was the problem as well. They were making it of paper rather than of metal. And the challenge that Mercedes had then is that people had an expectation.
Yeah.
And these cars were breaking down a bit more often. And then they had a few problems with rust. So what was happening was, is people, you know, my last E-Class lasted me for 25 years and never went wrong. This one's lasted me for 25 months.
Yeah.
So people's expectations were very high. And I was there during that challenging time. Now, you know, I'd say they've come back now and they're making some great kit. But yeah, that was wasn't easy for the company or for the people that were working for us.
So what was your big takeaway from that experience that helped you sort of going forward into other areas that you got into?
That's a really good question. I think one of the things...
I mean, particularly in the context of that being a difficult time for Mercedes. And as you said, you're disappointing loyal owners and you're kind of bearing the brunt of that.
Yeah, and I've always been the one, you know, I'm a big believer in good customer service. Bad service really, really appalls me. And we put on the best service we could, but of course you're dealing with a substandard at the time or perception of a substandard product. So it just shows that you can't build a car to a price, not when you've got that reputation. And Mercedes are not the only manufacturer that's done this. Other manufacturers have started building it to a price because the numbers people get involved, and that reputation very quickly erodes. And actually, and the inverse of that is if you look at the likes of Kia, people's perception of Kia back in the late, you know, kind of 2008 was they made cheap cars, but they made really reliable cars and they were pretty well built. And now they've got a great rep. So I think it's very much, you've got to deliver the product. It doesn't matter on the, you know, you can't just deliver the service. The product's got to be there as well. That's a takeaway. And the other thing that I found interesting when I was with them was we had an amazing amount of knowledge of the product. Mercedes are very, very supportive of retaining people, looking after their staff. And a lot of the people that work for me in Maastricht had come from the factories, had been with the business a long time. And they had an amazing amount of product knowledge. What they didn't know wasn't worth knowing. But they didn't necessarily know how to translate that into customer service. And the takeaway from that was you've got to put the right people in the right roles. Yeah. You can have great product specialists, great customer service people, but they don't always mix and match. So it's getting the right people in the right roles for me.
And also understanding that whole concept of communication, because that's what you need to do. When you're dealing with customers, and it's quite, and I talk to PR people, and I say, look, it's very different. You talk to journalists, and journalists are trained to understand, you know, the car industry and, you know, the challenges that you might be facing. Customers aren't. Customers can be blunt. They can be brutal. It's like you say, if a guy says, yeah, my car has been okay for 25 years. Why has this failed after 2 months? You know, and he's going to go around telling everybody, you know.
He is. And the biggest challenge for the industry, and everyone in the industry knows this, but I don't think consumers really appreciate it, is if you buy, and let's stick with Mercedes, I'm not putting them down, giving them a plug.
Yeah.
You buy a Mercedes from a retailer, and we won't mention any retailers, but you buy it from Bob the retailer, and that car goes wrong, and you go back to Bob the retailer, and Bob delivers you bad service.
Yeah.
A lot of consumers think Mercedes have delivered me a bad service, not Bob. And this is always the challenge in the retail industry. And there's that constant fight between retailers and manufacturers.
Yeah.
Is whose customer is it? And I'm selling a product, but you're servicing my customer. And I think that this is where the good dealer groups, and there are a few that I know that are absolutely excellent. And in fact, you talk Marshall Motors, they're fantastic at what they do. They deliver great service. They really look after their customers. Then there's a problem, they will resolve that. And they uphold the brand values. But there are others that don't. And vice versa, it can backfire on Marshall, because I'm a Marshall's customer. I go to them and I say, I've got a problem with my car. And Marshall goes to Mercedes and says, here's a problem. But Mercedes said, that's not covered. Then that customer's perception of Marshall is that they let me down. See, so it's a really interesting industry because no other industry has that.
Yeah.
You know, you go and buy a washing machine from Amazon or from Currys or something, and your hot point goes wrong.
Yeah.
You don't blame Currys for that. You blame hot point.
Yeah.
So it's a really interesting industry, I think, in that respect.
Yeah, I'm having that at the moment with HP in regards to my printer, which we've spoken about, haven't we?
We did speak about that. We won't mention that again, but I'm with you on that one, yeah.
We're moving on from that one. But it's a very interesting point because, as you know, obviously, I operated in the Middle East market. And there's a fundamental problem there in that, like over here, you have franchise dealers. And, you know, dealers can change and you can have several different dealer groups, you know, basically franchising your products. But in the Middle East, it's like it's the one dealer, that's it. It's the one family that owns that license, absolutely. And that's it. And it's an even bigger struggle there because they're really trying to, the manufacturer has a reputation, they have, you know, the CI and how they're going to deal with the customers. And then the dealers are like, well, you know, I sell X number of cars a month. I don't really care beyond that, you know, and it's
no, absolutely.
It's a constant struggle. And, it, you know, go on.
It really is. And one of the other challenges that we've got is now that these dealer groups, and there's one not far from me here, and on the same site, there's five brands. So I've been in and I've bought a Ford and I'm happy with that Ford and I'm happy with the service that I've got. And I go back to the dealer after 3 years to get a new car. But there isn't a Ford that I'm overly impressed with. But while I'm there, I happen to see that the Peugeot over there are quite fancy.
Yeah.
Now, the problem with Ford is Ford want that customer because they want you to stay in Ford products. Yeah. And you probably went in there thinking you would do. Yeah. Whereas that dealer, they don't really care what product you buy as long as you buy from them.
Yeah.
So it's quite a challenging, it's a challenging market. And they're always at crossheads with each other. They really are.
No, it's very, very interesting. And you stayed with the car industry then when you moved back, because then you were with Virgin Cars. That was short-lived though, wasn't it? Virgin Cars?
It was very short-lived, yeah. That was a really interesting time. So I came up with when it was just being set up and I helped them set up the operational side of that. So it was really looking after the customer service, looking after the sales pipeline once they were in.
But just briefly, this was an online selling experiment, wasn't it?
So, yeah, Virgin Cars were the very first of the online sales portals. So, you know, you're talking about the current crop that are out there now, and we've got a couple of them at the show. But it's not new. But this was before something that was called block exemption. So this is 2000. And at the time, and people that are as old as me might remember this. Of course, you won't because you're much younger than I am.
But yeah, right.
we were paying a lot more for our cars than they were in mainland Europe, and particularly if you talk BMW because of the tariffs and the way that it worked. And so Richard came up with a partner, came up with this idea, and we were buying cars from particularly Belgium and Germany, and we were buying them through the retail dealers over there and bringing them into the UK and registering them. So they were kind of grey imports.
Yeah.
And we were still able to do that and deliver the car cheaper. And in fact, you know, it could be $5,000 or $6,000 off a car. So the business model was really good.
Yeah.
The manufacturers clearly didn't like this
and
the retailers because we were taking money away from them, which I can understand. So with some of them, it wasn't always easy to get the product in because, you know, a Belgian dealer is ordering a right-hand drive vehicle. It's pretty obvious that it's not a local vehicle. Yeah. So there was always delay. So our service, again, was challenged because we were waiting for the car to turn up and it was being delayed in the build. But of course, they didn't blame the manufacturer. They blamed us.
Yeah.
So that car that was 3 months down. And there's one really great example of how bad service can really, really impact a customer. We had a vehicle. It was a convertible, a German convertible car that we'd ordered. It was due in 3 months. It took 7.5. And it turned up. And it was delivered to the customer, and it had gone through all the PDIs at the factory, at the Belgium dealer, at the UK delivery point, and it was delivered to him. And the guy looked at this car, and it was a dark blue car, and someone had put an olive green roof on it, which wasn't a color combo you could get. And it's certainly not one that anyone, I don't think, in the right mind would order. And no one had picked up that got the wrong color roof. And this guy stood there after 7.5 months and looked at this car and said, "What the hell?" And just rejected it out. And of course, that clearly there was a fault in our side, but right from this point here, and it was that product let him down again. But it was an interesting time at Virgin. You know, we did upset the apple cart a little bit. You know, we sold a few cars, and then block exemption came in, which leveled the playing field. And I think it was early days for people buying online. It was the enlightened few. We sold a few hundred cars. And we just have to bow out gracefully. But Richard Branson, being Richard Branson, managed to use that as a PR stunt and said, Virgin Cars have managed to bring block exemption, so we've reduced the price of cars for everybody.
Okay,
he's good at that stuff.
Silver lining, silver lining.
Yeah, absolutely.
But just for a minute, staying with the online environment, because we've seen an increase of that now, haven't we? Especially, you know, due to the current situation with COVID and stuff. A lot of people are looking at that as basically the future of car retailing.
Yeah, I think online is playing a bigger and bigger part, and it has done for a while. But I still think a lot of people will want to see that vehicle at some point. I think new cars, if you're buying yourself a Focus or a mid-range kind of car, that's
something that's very common and people know.
Yeah, absolutely. An out-the-box car, you're probably more likely and more comfortable to buy, particularly if you're replacing what you've already got. So yeah. I've got a Focus. It's 3 years. I'm very happy. I've seen one or a friend's got one. I'll buy it. But I think for the more bespoke stuff, people will still want to be involved and buy it. And if nothing else, try it. And this we'll come to the show in a moment, but this is the whole point about putting people behind the wheel. It's not a washing machine. You don't look at a list and go, it does this much, it costs me this much. It's about the feel. So I think there will be a group of people that will buy online, but I still think a lot of people will want to experience that vehicle at some point. They may not want to buy it through a dealership, but they'll want to experience it. They'll want to sit in it. They'll want to maybe test drive it. And that's, of course, where we're going to try and help. I think used is a really interesting one. And we know that a number of people have dipped their toes in the past. Tesco's did a couple of years ago. We all know that that didn't work. Amazon looked at it. And the problem is, because used cars, they're all very different, and it's a condition thing. My version of a car and your version of a car may be very different.
Yeah, you describe something as good, and he describes something as immaculate, and then the punter turns up and says, that's quite poor, actually. The perceptions are very different there, because there's not a standard.
So I'll search online. I'll make my decisions on the kind of cars I want to go and check out. I might even secure it online, and I'll get my finance set up, and I'll do all of that so I can transact to a certain point. But I still think for the foreseeable future, the majority then will probably want to then collect it or have some check over before they literally sign on that line.
Yeah.
In the near term, I think that's what will happen. I think that the chances and use of people going A through to Z completely online are still relatively low, but it will grow. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that the cars are, I mean, you know, as you've clearly demonstrated, having owned 150 cars and regretting selling some of them, you know, cars are an emotional purchase. You know, they're a tactile thing. They're something that you want to touch, feel, drive, and get to know before you decide, yeah, you know, this is the second biggest investment for most people after a house. So you want to be sure when you make that decision. Let's move on to 7 years you spent working at Black Ball Media. What's Black Ball Media and what did you do there?
So Black Ball Media is it's an automotive media company, and we produced automotive content. So we would write car reviews. It's the kind of stuff that you know all about. You know, we'd write car reviews, we'd produce videos, we produced magazines, and we did automotive events. And I joined when James Baggett first set the business up, and I helped him take it through, and I was managing director of the business. So I really helped develop that from a small business that had a niche publication, but a lot of great content and a fantastic team, right through to, you know, seven times the revenue within that 7 years. And we were producing content that got 15 million eyeballs a month.
Wow.
And that, as I mentioned before, for a petrol head like me, this was fantastic because I'm in a business now. And as you'll know, for these businesses, manufacturers will give you a car for a week or a month, whatever it may be, that you test drive it, you write about it, and then you say great things. So we were seeing hundreds of cars.
Sometimes.
Some of them. But, you know, over the last 7 years, I've got to drive pretty much everything on the UK roads from, you know, I was one of the first people in a Renault Zoe.
Yeah, all right.
I lost you there for a second. I was one of the first people in a Renault Zoe. Which I have a 90 mile commute to the office, and it did 86 miles of charge. So that was always a challenge. But you know, to McLarens and the top end Ferraris and a Rolls Royce Silver Dawn, I'll never forget.
Yeah.
So you know, got to drive these fantastic cars, and we produce content for a whole load of different people. Press Association, a big part of that. It's, you know, probably most people will have probably seen some of the stuff that we wrote.
UK focused or was it international as well?
No, it was UK focused. I think for automotive press, it's very difficult to be internationally focused. because the models that are relevant here might not be relevant elsewhere. So it was all UK focused. So we produced content. We did some great videos. We had a lot of fun making car videos. And then that's how I got to the event side of things. We were running trade events and getting involved with manufacturers and helping support their launch events as well.
Just going back to the content, is that during the time that you were there, is that when you found that there was this transition between traditional media and new media, such as digital?
Yeah, we saw very quickly the different types of demographic and the different types of news. And I think you'll appreciate this, where people now get their daily digest of news online. So the magazines that we were producing were monthly magazines. And over a period of time, the news section, which was quite a hefty part to begin with, really reduced. It was just the headlines, because at the end of the month, people have seen that. So your news is being digested online very quickly. Where we found it worked in a printed format was in, so we put features together. Might be road tests, might be how-tos, might be interviews, but it was the kind of stuff that you wouldn't find online. So a good example, once a year we did the road test of the year, and we'd get five or six of our favorite cars of that year, take them off to Wales, put them through their paces, get amazing photography, and then we'd create a six-page spread in the magazines. It would go online, and that would go out to a number of different places. That's the kind of stuff that you can't go online and necessarily find very easily. That people, they'll pick up the magazine, they'll read it, and they'll love the gloss and actually the in-depth coverage.
It's interesting. I mean, that's a whole other discussion about the future of magazines and the future of print. But let's move on to events, because you touched on that. And of course, you then got involved with the London Motor Show. Is event something that you'd always sort of migrated towards? Is that something that was like an end goal for you? Like, I'm going to do this? Or is it something that just came about?
No, I think even in my early days, I was involved in different types of events and some very strange stuff. I mean, for example, very, very early days of running contact centres, I was involved with the Red Nose Day stuff on BBC.
Right.
We were one of the contact centres that had run through the night, taking their calls and collecting their fundings. And that in itself is like an event. So setting up these big event type projects has always been in my blood. And I kind of naturally gravitated into automotive and automotive events. And I was involved in setting up some test drive events. And then at the time with Black Ball, we started getting involved in more and more consumer stuff. Mm-hmm. And we put on a number of really big award ceremonies. And we brought an event to the UK called CDX, or we launched it. And I'd been out to the US. There's a trade event called NADA that many people in the automotive trade will know about. And I discovered that loads of people from the UK were going to it because they didn't have one over here. So we launched that in 2014, and that's still going great guns, and I'm still very involved in that. So launching events and getting them off the ground has always been a passion of mine, and I, you know, over 7 or 8 years, got a lot of experience of doing that. And then I was asked to help the team at London, and I went in there and I helped for a year, and I brought in a lot of my contacts. And I think we fundamentally changed the show from what it had been previously. It had been quite a small show previously, perhaps missing the mark. And, you know, despite the guys there not really having a lot of budget and therefore, as a result, not being able to commit to much space, we delivered a lot more. And I managed to bring in a lot of interesting content. The problem with that show is it wasn't big enough. It needed to be at least twice the size.
So specifically, what did you do in terms of taking it from where it was to what you did with it?
Content. And that's probably where my biggest strength is. So looking at, you know, taking my 20 years experience of knowing what people who buy cars like, knowing what manufacturers want, and of course my own passion for cars, what do I like? And that's a bit of a barometer in this. Looking at that, having been to every motor show I could since I was that big, and knowing what I wanted to see and what I enjoyed there. So I looked at that and looked at what we had, and it was a little bit like, I think, with some of the motor shows in Europe have been and suffered before I came along, very static, relatively not dynamic at all. I wouldn't say dull, that's the wrong word, but it was very static. Group of cars, you look out, have a wander around, and you're done. And unless you're engaging with people, you're in and you're out very quickly.
I mean, the way I often describe it is like paying money to go into a giant showroom.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly it. So, you know, some people, they'll like the fact that all the cars are there and there's some very nice cars. But ultimately, you're looking at a static car. You'll have a look at it, you'll walk on. And it wasn't very diverse. They didn't have an awful lot of the manufacturer brands there as well. I think that was part of the challenge. So it just lacked, I think, a bit of passion. So I looked at bringing it alive and trying to bring in something a little bit more unusual. So we developed the live stage quite extensively, and I used a lot of my contacts there, brought in a few people like Mike Brewer and Tim and Fuzz and those guys. And we started delivering fun content. So it's not just about the static car, it's about the fun content. So we'll go along, we'll have a laugh, we'll do a quiz, I can take part in something. So the live stage was a big part of that. We had a lot of really interesting interviews on there. Yeah. We then had the live arena, and the live arena, we had Paul Swift in. I brought him along, and he did some really good shows there. And we started doing supercar parades. So, you know, supercars are always a big draw, particularly for kids. We had a supercar paddock, but again, you know, why should that be static? So let's get them in the arena. So what we did is we brought them out, and once a day we had a supercar parade in the arena, and we'd put 10 or 12 of these cars around the arena. They'd get in the arena, they'd give it a little bit of beans, and they'd kind of fly around, not too fast, but there was a lot of noise and a lot of excitement. And people got to see two Bugattis, the Chiron and the Veyron together, driving round. Many people have never even seen one, let alone moving. So there's that dynamic element there. And it was all just about the content and bringing different elements in. We had being quite small, but we introduced a marketplace element. And I did a lot for EV, brought in an EV section. And working with all the manufacturers, I managed to use some of my relationships to bring these guys in. And it's really working with them, say, take a large space, put one car in the middle and rope it off. Manufacturers in some shows, they're guilty of doing this. It's a beauty parade. There's no point in doing that. What we want you to do is bring vehicles that people can get in, that can sit and can actually experience, and then talk to people about this car. Because that way, people will remember your vehicle, and there's an opportunity to sell. So I'll try to introduce that idea of let's transact at the show. And I did a lot of what I wanted to do, but sadly, there was a lot there that we couldn't do. We maybe didn't have quite the budgets we needed. We didn't have quite, you know, the size of footprint. But it was really the blueprint of what I'm now doing in the British Motor Show.
So this is the thing. I mean, it's a pretty brave move to go from, you know, helping out with a show to then having this grand plan and then basically doing it yourself, which is what you're doing. And you are a little bit of a one-man band, I know, because I get all the emails from you and everything, you know. But sitting in on that press conference that we did, it was earlier this year, wasn't it, I think?
We did a couple. The first one was November last year,
It was November last year. So I remember sitting in and listening to that conference, and I've been involved in the Dubai Motor Show for a few years whilst I was out there. And we were planning an event for Dubai that we were thinking of as the next evolution of motor shows, which of course is a big thing now, you know, especially like trying to do this in an environment where motor shows around the world seem to be diminishing and dying away, let's be honest. And then listening to a lot of the stuff that you were talking about at that press conference, I was getting deja vu. I was like, hang on, that's what I was thinking. So there's a commonality there about the show aspect of the motor show is the ingredient that I think has been missing. And I think that's the bit that needs to be brought back. But still, that's a massive task that you're taking on, you know, in the current circumstances. And that's without COVID.
Yeah, COVID hasn't helped us, unfortunately. But we've had to reschedule from this year. Actually, what it has done is it's given me an extra year to really plan this. But I think you've hit the nail on the head. It's the show element. And we are, this is the evolution. We say it's not just a motor show or more than a motor show. We'll still have all the cars. You'll still be able to go and see them. We're not, that's just a part of this. So I do have, you're right, we're a small team. I've got three people on the team full time, but we have an extended team now of about 10 people working on the show because we're going to need it. But to give you an idea, diversity is a really big part of this show. So we've got classic car halls. It's not a motor show thing, but people like to see classic cars. We've got motorsport. We've got obviously the new car stuff as you'd expect. We've got a tech hall. We've got EVs covered. We've got test drives. People don't do that at motor shows normally. You'll be able to come in, get in the car, and take it for a drive. And then we've got the live arena, which is, you know, an amazing thing. We've really evolved that arena now. That's just going to be going constantly. I've got, I think, about 12 active, what we call activations, where people can get into vehicles, whether they're being test driven round in a Caterham and made sick by one of their specialist drivers. Paul Swift is going to be teaching people how to stunt drive. The Sporting Bears are there. We got a kids zone. We got Record Breakers going to be there. It's just so much more than a motor show.
Yeah.
And what we're trying to do is, a lot of people are trying, well, you know, who are you competing with? So we're not competing with anybody here.
Yeah.
We're a little bit of everything, and that's what makes us different, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
We are a festival of cars, I think, around motoring. So your car lover will be there. They'll love all the stuff that we're doing. Then you'll get your families, because we've got a great family day out. There's so much they can do. Then you've got your car buyers. They'll be there because we're going to be offering car buying advice and be able to talk to experts, get in the cars, take it for a test drive. And then your tech fans will love it as well, because we're really going to be heavily promoting the next level of mobility, EV, hybrid, hydrogen, all of that stuff. So it's a place where whether you just like one of those four things, you'll be happy, and then you'll remember the rest. And the way that I'm approaching this is remembering when I was a child and I loved the motor show, and thinking that I think we've disengaged with the younger generation, and I want to re-engage with them.
Yeah.
So they'll turn up, and they might come because they really like the under 17 driving. So children between the ages of 10 and 17 will be able to get driving lessons. So they'll come for that. But whilst they're there, they'll see the classic car hall, which they may have never thought about, or they'll see the motorsport section, and we'll be introducing a new group of people to motorsport. So when you look at the other shows, and we hope that they'll all come back at some point. I know some of them are the early part of the year, but we want to support the likes of Autosport and Goodwood and the NEC Classic Show, because they are the more specialist shows, and we're trying to bring new customers to them as well.
So you're like an umbrella event, but also I think it's something even more than that. I mean, you essentially are poised at a moment in history, because if you're able to pull this off, and if you're able to create this new style or this new evolution of a motor show, this could essentially be a template for global events going forward.
I think it will be. I think they have to be honest with you. I think, Geneva, a lot of people lament Geneva's, it's the end of Geneva. They haven't been able to put the show on for 2 years, but I don't think that's true. They're getting 600,000 people through the door. That is not a show that's not successful.
Mm-hmm.
Where Geneva struggles, and you talk to any manufacturers, they're just too expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And, a manufacturer is spending millions on a relatively small stand, and they're never going to justify that money back in sales. So it's a bit of a beauty parade. So they've got to change. So they've got to, you've got to take less revenue from the manufacturers. And in comparison, a manufacturer comes to us for a few thousand, not a few million. So therefore it's a different kind of concept.
So a few thousand versus a few million, but going for a greater impact, and that ability to remain in people's mind by creating a show, by creating something that people can engage with. Because people turning up at motor shows don't really care if the stand costs 3 million or 3,000.
No. They want to sit in a car. They want to be able to walk around a car. And if they can get in and drive it, even better. They want to experience things. And that's what we're delivering. So you're right. This is an experience that I think other motor shows are watching. And it wouldn't surprise me if Geneva, when they come back in 2022, because they will be back, start to have an element of interactivity that maybe they've taken from us. And, I'd be very proud of that.
No, absolutely. So just before we wrap up, where do things stand at the moment? Because obviously new rules are coming out all the time. We were just speaking about an event that we both know has been cancelled. You were planning an event over Christmas as well, weren't you?
Yeah. So we had something called Cars and Christmas, which was a smaller event, and that we were going to take nationally. And that was an arena show with Paul, but wrapped around a marketplace. So it was a great place to go and get the petrol head in your life, present. And that was looking really good. And we had a lot of interest in that. But given the recent announcements, we've decided that it would not be wise to go ahead. We just couldn't put it off in an arena environment. So we've had to schedule that till next year. But that will be happening next year. And we're going to have one in the south, one in the north, possibly one in the west as well. But for the main show, so we're back in August. August the 19th to 22nd, we're at Farnborough. It's been a challenge because we've had to postpone a year. But all of the exhibitors that were with us have just moved across, so they're all very much behind us. The ticket sales, people, they've had the option to get the money back, and they've stayed with us. So we've already got, you know, a few thousand tickets secured. And what it's done is it's given us an extra 12 months to come up with even better ideas. And I've come up with three or four really interesting ideas that we've, that we're now delivering ahead of that. So where do we start? You know, it's the end of August that, you know, they're talking about where we are with COVID and lockdowns. Worst case, it's 6 months. And I'm fairly confident by spring next year, we'll be out of this. The nice thing about our show is it's indoor and outdoor over acres of space. We've got 30,000 in square meters indoor, acres outdoor. So even if we have to socially distance, we've got plenty of space to do that. So we will be able to deliver this show and deliver it well, even if there are still certain guidelines in place. But fingers crossed there won't be by then.
That's awesome. I'll tell you, like I've said to you before, I was really pumped about it this year and I was a bit disappointed, but I'm still really pumped about it. I think it's going to be exciting. I can't wait to see how this turns out. And thanks so much for talking to us today, Andy, and all power to you, man.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to seeing you soon.
Oh, you know, I was really gutted not to have the British Motor Show this year, but I'm equally excited about it happening next year. I can't wait to go to it, and I hope you guys are going to be there too. And together we can explore what the next generation of motor shows actually will look like, because that's hopefully what this is going to be. Let me know what you think the next generation of motor shows should be or will look like or should look like. Also, let me know if you've owned more cars than Andy. Over 150. If you have, I think we need to talk. I think we need to do one of these because that's just phenomenal. I mean, I don't even know how you keep count of that many cars. That's incredible. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this video. Let me know what you thought about it in the comments above below elsewhere. Make sure that you are subscribing to youtube.com/browncarguy. Make sure you follow me on all the social media channels. Just search for hashtag browncarguy on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Subscribe to browncarguy.com. And if you enjoy my content and my videos, then please consider sponsoring my content from as little as £2.50 a month on patreon.com/ShazadSheikh. And big shout out and thanks to people that have already done so. That includes Muhammad Ali Ahmed in the UAE, Partha over in India, Tom Conway Gordon here in the UK, and Isaac in America. You guys rock. Thanks so much for doing that. Maybe you can join them as well. Even if you can't, don't worry. Just please continue to like, comment, share, subscribe. That's all really important. Thanks so much for doing that. Thanks so much for watching, and I'll see you again soon in the next one.